all those federal dollars are really enticing. They are, but they're not free. And in fact, they're paid for by debt and by printing more money.
Governor Parnell says no to expanding Medicaid to include more uninsured Alaskans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an airplane trip inspires a unique idea for teaching a dying language.
I was looking out the window and I realized, you know, I can count to 10 without moving my lips in Tlingit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public. Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Governor Parnell announced today he won't expand Medicaid in Alaska. Medicaid expansion is a key provision of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. It would offer health coverage to an estimated 40,000 low-income Alaskans. Parnell says he doesn't want to attach Alaskans' health care or finances to a failing Obamacare system. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
A small group of women stood outside of the governor's office building in downtown Anchorage, singing and praying Parnell would decide to expand Medicaid. Their prayers were not answered.
I believe a costly Medicaid expansion, especially on top of the broken Obamacare system, is a hot mess.
With the announcement, Parnell released an analysis of Medicaid expansion in Alaska prepared by the Lewin Group, a healthcare consulting agency. It was completed in April. APRN filed a Freedom of Information request for the report in June, but the state decided to keep it secret until now. It shows Medicaid expansion would bring $3 billion into Alaska through 2020 and cost the state just $240 million. That's because the federal government would pay for 100% of the program in the first 3 years and then gradually reduce the matching rate to 90%. Parnell says that math was appealing.
All those federal dollars are really enticing. They are, but they're not free. And in fact, they're paid for by debt and by printing more money. They're paid for by our kids and grandkids. And they also come with the price of financial dependence upon the federal government to a greater extent than we are today.
Medicaid is already one of the largest spending items in the state budget, and Parnell cited that as another reason to refuse federal money to expand the program. Parnell is establishing an advisory group to reform Medicaid to help control costs. Since the health care law was designed to include Medicaid expansion, Parnell's decision will leave 20,000 low-income Alaskans with no reasonable option for getting health insurance. He says he wants to find a way to get those Alaskans better access to health care.
And I have committed to Alaskans and to these providers that we would work to address those gaps in access.
Several organizations have come out in support of Medicaid expansion, including the Anchorage and Alaska Chambers of Commerce, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and AARP Alaska. Ken Osterkamp is state director for AARP. He's incredulous that the governor could ignore such a wide range of Alaskans.
I don't know who he's listening to. I don't know what organizations have come out opposing Medicaid expansion. It's really almost an unprecedented spectrum of support. And yet the governor chose to make the decision and to make it in secret, not to do what everybody seems to want.
Governor Parnell hasn't completely closed the door on Medicaid expansion. He says he is willing to consider a model that is tailored to the specific needs of Alaskans. Susan Johnson is the regional director with the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. She says Parnell has not actively pursued an alternative.
I know the secretary has talked to him with a welcome sign open for bring to us your ideas and let us begin a conversation, as Arkansas did, as Idaho has done, as other states have done. But there was no engagement from the governor with us.
Parnell indicated he would want to limit the expansion to only 100% of the federal poverty level instead of 133%. The federal government has said states that do that won't be eligible for the same generous matching rates. Still, Johnson is hopeful Parnell will reconsider and says he can change his mind anytime and opt Alaska into the program. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The worst appears to be over for coastal villages in western Alaska. State Emergency Incident Commander Mark Roberts says a return to a more normal weather pattern with clear, cold conditions is forecast.
The rough weather that started November 5th with the first storms and a series of five storms that came through even yesterday, which was the, in fact, part of that storm, that last fifth storm was resulted in the power outages there from ice in the Fairbanks area. That series of storms has completed, and at least for the going forward for the next 5 to 7 days, it's looking like clear sailing.
Roberts says Kotlik, Stebbins, Scammon Bay, Tununak, and Shishmaref have all declared local disasters. He says 18 communities have reported impacts. Roberts says there have been no reports of injuries or anyone missing. He attributes that to good planning by communities before the storm started. Kotlik and Unalakleet are still working to get their water systems restored. Roberts says Kotlik has a week's worth of drinking water in their storage tank, and Unalakleet has a temporary water collection system above ground. Thousands remain without power in the Fairbanks area. Given the massive weather events that have shaken up coastal communities in Alaska and the Philippines this month, two state legislators are asking their constituents to support relief efforts on both fronts. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
When Super Typhoon Haiyan swept through the Philippines, it walloped the rural western province of Auckland. Phones and internet still appear to be down, and the information that is making its way out of Auckland isn't promising. There are reports that 11 people have died in the province, and more than 9,000 homes were leveled. Alaska State Representative Kathy Munoz remembers what the province was like a year ago, when she and Representative Bob Herron went there for a trade mission. It was Alaska's first ever official visit to the Philippines. Munoz says there was a huge welcome lined up when they reached Auckland's capital city.
Just about the entire community came out to greet us. Thousands of people lined the street as we were getting out of the car to attend a reception in our honor. They had bands and hundreds of marchers greeting us. It was just an overwhelming experience.
While Munoz and Herron were in the Philippines, they talked to dozens of legislators and educators about everything from fisheries exports to new university exchange programs. They even laid the groundwork for a sister city partnership between Juneau and the provincial capital of Kalibo. There was a lot of work left to do, but since the typhoon, Munoz and Herron haven't heard from any of their contacts in Auckland. While they and other Alaskans wait for word from typhoon-struck areas, Munoz says there are ways to offer aid now.
The Filipino community here in Juneau is having an event very soon, and I donated to that event so that we can raise monies that will be, you know, sent home.
Long before her trade mission, Munoz says Alaskans and Filipinos had developed a bond.
The Filipino people have made contributions to the development of the territory and the state for years and years. I think it's really important that we come together as a community to support the Philippines and the people that have direct connection to the land and to the devastation.
In Herron's district, Unalaska's PhilAm Association is holding a dinner on Saturday to raise money for aid organizations, too. Herron says his constituents should attend that event if they can, but he also urges them to think about relief efforts more broadly and to consider what's going on here in Alaska. A string of false storms has been wreaking havoc on the western part of the state. They've damaged homes and chewed up water and sewer systems. The village of Kotlik is asking the state to declare a disaster there, and others are expected to follow suit. Rebuilding in Kotlik and other remote villages is going to be tough. To help, Herron says he gave to the Red Cross.
In terms of what happened in Kotlik and the terms of what happened in the Philippines, it's a very small donation. But I want the money to go to coastal communities that are affected by tremendous weather events.
There's another common thread that connects Alaska and the Philippines, though. It goes beyond shared culture or economic interests, and it could be to blame for creating such powerful storms to begin with. Herron says the underlying factor is climate change.
All of us, I mean, this is people that live on this planet, we have to recognize what is happening And we're going to have to realize that there are, could be many benefits to the changes that are happening. And we got to try to minimize the impacts. And that's a tall order.
It's also a long-term goal. Right now, survivors on Alaska's coast and in the Philippines are facing immediate challenges. They need the basics, Heron says, and then they can try to start over. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska tribal leaders meet with high-level officials in the Obama administration.
We've never had a president or administration that's paid this much attention to us. And for the first time ever, we have a voice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank of Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for more than 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Tribal leaders from Alaska and the rest of the country had a chance this week to talk with the highest powers in the federal government. Nearly all of President Obama's cabinet secretaries participated in the annual White House Tribal Nations Conference, as did Obama himself. APRN's Liz Ruskin caught up with some of the Alaska delegates at a reception in Washington.
The gathering is an Obama initiative to reach out to tribes and show his administration is listening. Ted Mala, who in past years represented Buckland, says the value is enormous.
We've never had a president or administration that's paid this much attention to us. And for the first time ever, we have a voice, in my opinion. We've had degrees of it with other administrations, but this one has blown the doors open, and it's incredible.
Will Micklin came representing the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Tribes. He says the highlight for him was hearing the president mention contract support costs. It was a reference to the decades-long failure of the government to fully pay tribes for services they provide, primarily health care.
We require that they fulfill their obligations and their commitments in order that we can most effectively govern ourselves, and it starts with paying your contractual obligations.
Obama, though, only said he'd heard their call for full reimbursement and pledged to work with Congress to find a solution. Micklin says when tribal leaders show their faces every year, it helps hold the president accountable for his promises. Micklin believes the conference can produce results.
It's beginning to. We know the president means what he says. We have sometimes have difficulty with his key officials, department secretaries and agent heads of agencies and bureaus. And so we're trying to close the gap between what the president promises and what his key officials deliver.
Marianne Mills of the Kenaitse tribe said the best part for her was a smaller session she attended with top Interior Department personnel.
I was a little disappointed with the President Obama, because he did not mention Alaska one time in his speech. I thought maybe he would say something about our health care and about the violence against women and the high suicide rate, and I thought he would, you know, lend a little more support than what he did.
Just before the conference, Obama invited a dozen Native American leaders to the White House for a special meeting. The only Alaskan among them wasn't the leader of a tribe, but a corporation, Chris McNeil, CEO of Sea Alaska. He says he focused on three issues: subsistence rights, changes to the 8A program that helps Native corporations win government contracts, and community development financing. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Since the legislature gaveled out this spring, state officials have been trying to build support for a controversial land management bill that couldn't get enough votes in the final days of session. Public meetings were supposed to be part of their outreach effort, but APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that the Department of Natural Resources has called those meetings off.
Last month, Ed Fogles took to the opinion pages of the Anchorage Daily News. As a deputy commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources, he had problems with the paper's coverage of his agency. He wrote that DNR was doing a better job of managing the state's waters than they were getting credit for, and that a lot of the department's issues could be solved by a bill already under consideration by the legislature. Fogels also committed to public meetings because he felt that both the bill and DNR's process were misunderstood.
I really thought we would be still on track to do something like that. And then as we started really kind of trying to put it together, we realized, you know, it's not going to be very workable. So I have to eat crow on that.
Fogel says with the holidays coming up and the legislative session just 2 months away, his staff wouldn't be able to pull off meetings around the state. Instead, DNR will be meeting with stakeholder groups and fielding individual calls. Fogel says that requires less time for notice and involves less staff effort. They've already given 15 presentations on the matter.
Any of us will talk to anybody at any time. So if someone has questions on the bill, they should email us or give us a call. We'll call them back on our nickel.
House Bill 77 is long and sweeping. It's one of Governor Sean Parnell's priorities, and the goal is to streamline the permitting process. Fogel says that DNR has been dealing with a backlog of paperwork because people will use the existing statutes to block projects.
We get a lot of frivolous challenges to our decisions that really we're trying to make it so that people actually have to kind of justify a little bit more about why they would actually be harmed by a DNR decision, rather than just not liking it, sitting in an armchair in some other part of the world, just, you know, throwing monkey wrenches at our decisions. I don't think that's good public policy or right.
HB 77 has provisions that limit who can appeal DNR's decisions, and it only allows public entities to apply for water reservations. For those not immersed in environmental politics, a water reservation guarantees a certain level of flow for a given stream or river, and the objective is usually to conserve fish habitat. That means that individuals, nonprofits, and even tribal groups would no longer be able to ask for that protection from the state. The bill also gives the commissioner power to issue general permits, which don't need public notice, to projects so long as the project is unlikely to cause significant and irreparable harm to the land. Because so much of HB 77 deals with the public process, those meetings have taken on a symbolic importance to people with concerns about the legislation. Rick Halford is a Republican who served in the Alaska legislature for 2 decades, and he's been a vocal opponent of Pebble Mine since retiring from public life. Halford doesn't like HB 77 as it's written, and he thinks the state should be coming to affected communities to explain why it's needed.
It's kind of ironic that one of their reasons for the bill in the first place was to reduce public involvement in the process, because they thought it was too much. So now they're not having hearings to allow the public more access to the process of changing the process.
Halford thinks that if DNR were to hold meetings on their permitting strategy, they would get a big turnout in affected communities.
I think they definitely would have in Western Alaska, and I think they would have in the Kenai Peninsula. I think they would, and they would attend from both sides.
Because HB 77 has already passed in the House and has gone through the committee process in the Senate, it's unclear if there will be opportunities for public testimony on the bill when the legislature reconvenes in January. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories, and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Jeremy Shea. This week on AK, puppets. Like many other indigenous languages, Tlingit is in survival mode. Revitalizing the language was the focus of a Tlingit conference held in Juneau last week. A Juneau resident has one solution for how to keep the language alive. During a conference session, Carlton Smith gave participants a lesson in how to teach Tlingit to children with puppets. And as KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, he does it with the help of a special guest.
Charlie's Tlingit name is Shinakawa. He identifies his moiety, his clan, and where he's from. Charlie is wearing gray Carhartt overalls, long underwear, a green and white flannel shirt, and tan work boots. He has a full head of gray hair, dark bushy eyebrows and mustache, and black-rimmed glasses. He's roughly 3.5 feet tall and can only talk when he's sitting on Carlton Smith's lap.
What do you think of that?
Smith got into ventriloquism 50 years ago as a 10-year-old boy living in Haines. When Smith was bedridden with hepatitis for 4 months, his father bought him his first puppet from a Sears Roebuck catalog, a red-headed figure wearing a green suit named Jerry.
There were children walking below my bedroom window, and Jerry and I were talking to them as they would walk home from school. Now, the first day or two, there were 5 or 6 children. The second day, there were 8 or 9. By the end of the week, there were 20 children that came to see this little green man that wanted to talk to them from a second-story window.
Like many childhood toys, Jerry was eventually forgotten until 3 years ago when Smith rediscovered Jerry in a trunk. Then, another discovery on a flight to Anchorage.
I was looking out the window and I realized, you know, I can count to 10 without moving my lips in Tlingit. And then I was going right down the list of clans and the place names, and I thought, ooh, this is kind of cool.
That's how Smith got the idea of doing Tlingit ventriloquism, but he wasn't sure how the community would receive it. So he went to the late Tlingit elder and religious leader, Dr. Walter Sobolev, for advice. Sobolev liked the idea, but said it couldn't be done with Jerry. He advised Smith to create a new figure, a native one.
My namesake, Shanakawa, means in the image of the ancient people. Walter said, he was one of my best friends from Killisnoo. He said, what you do is you create a brand new figure in the image of the person you're named after.
Smith looks at Charlie.
That's who this is, Shanakawa.
Shinakawa is the Tlingit name of Charlie James of Klukwan, who would be 108 years old if he were alive today. Smith never met his namesake. Using photos of Charlie James, Smith worked with a figure maker in Michigan on details like skin tone and hair color. Smith tells participants at the Tlingit Language Conference that Charlie was created for one main purpose.
This is really about children.
For a year and a half, Smith and Charlie went to Tlingit and Haida Head Start every Friday.
These little kids would just want to grab him, claw him.
Charlie would sing songs in Tlingit and count to 10.
Kick!
Kick!
Dig!
Dig!
Nutsk!
Nutsk!
Smith says children are captivated by the animation, which makes learning Tlingit easier. Later on in the conference session, participants are asked to pair up and make basic Tlingit dialogue with sock puppets, an activity that can be done with children. Two Tlingit teachers, Robbie Littlefield and Bessie Jim, pair up.
She asked me what my name was, and I pretended not to hear her.
Neither has spoken the language with puppets before, but both like the idea. Jim says she'll bring the technique back to her students in Carcross, Yukon.
I think they'll get a lot more out of it, and it's more fun. And my brother used to say, the language is fun. He said, they're always laughing.
Littlefield says teaching with puppets can help her middle school students in Sitka with something they're working on right now.
We're learning the animal names, and we have little stuffed animals and little hard animals. So they're going to learn the name of the animals and then talk to each other
in a whatever puppet voice they choose.
The most important thing, says Smith, is having fun. His goal at the conference was to share a different way of teaching Tlingit to children, a way that might breathe new life into a challenging task. And he hopes Charlie will help accomplish that. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Kayana, a village of about 350 people on the Kobuk River, about 30 miles north of the Arctic Circle.
Bertha Barr. I live in Kayana. I work for the Food Distribution Reservation and Indian Reserve, FDPIR. It's just where I lived my whole life, and it's what I'm used to, and all the friendly people in my family and all the subsistence lifestyle and all that. We have mountains around, and there's three rivers. That's what the native village of Kayak means, where three rivers meet. It's the Kobuk River, and it's the Skool River, and it's a small channel. Summertime, there's sandbars all over. There's a sandbar right in front. There's sandbars on the side. Summertime, you know, we go out boating, fishing for salmon and for sheafish. Wintertime, we go out hunting for caribou and birds. The rivers are starting to freeze over. They're actually ice fishing right now, and they're catching what we call pikdalak. The summertime, we have this company. It's called Kayana Lodge, so they get actually people, tourists, and they come and go stay at the lodge and go fishing or hunting. It's just a real beautiful town and friendly people, and come and visit.
Bertha Barr works for Kayana's food distribution program. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lisa Fu, Monica Goki, Annie Fight, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.